This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
Great film. Great film. Thank you. I'm Wendy Ely Jackson. I'm a lecturer here in Film and Media Studies as well as the College of Creative Studies. I just want to thank Carsey Wolf Center and the entire team, our students, our interns, as well as the university. And this is a very exciting moment for me because I've worked with Sam in the past, but he is someone that you have to have a lot of stamina to keep up with in this art form. So Sam, I know your background, but let's start, but what made you get into documentaries?
Well, as a young man at 21 years old, I was going to Baruch College in New York City, and mm-hmm. I was taking a lot of marketing courses with the idea I was going to be a businessman. And I was miserable in my junior year. And I went to see a college counselor, my college counselor, and I said I was looking for some after-school internship. And she asked me, what do you like? And I said I loved reading books, and I loved old Hollywood movies. And she told me about a program that had been started in 1968 at the public television station in New York after Dr. King's assassination that was looking to get more people of color behind the scenes, in the editing room, shooting, doing sound, producing. It was a one-year workshop, two nights a week, and then you went out on the weekends and you shot films, your little films, and you would get a job as an assistant or a camera person or the editor. And I got into this program and I gravitated to the editing. And at the end of that 1 year of that program, I got a job on a feature film that was directed by a gentleman named Bill Gunn, who was an actor, playwright, director, and the film was titled Ganja and Hess. And I was the apprentice editor. I would sweep the edit room, get tea for the editor, reconstitute the trims, and at the end of that job, the editor, a gentleman named Victor Konevsky, took me out to lunch, and he says to me, Sam, I think you're a very nice young man. But I don't think you got a lot of talent. And he says, I'm getting ready to do a documentary, and I want to hire you. He says, you're not really good enough to be an assistant editor yet. I'm going to make you my apprentice assistant, and I'm going to give you a $25 raise. And I went from $50 a week to $75 a week. And I was his assistant editor for 3 years. And I always say for that experience was like going to graduate school, because a couple of days a week, he would have me stop my assistant's work. And he would tell me to sit behind him when he was editing on the steam deck, flatbed editing machine. And he would explain all of the editing decisions he made, why he would use a dissolve, why he would go to a straight cut, why he would use a certain piece of an interview. And then he'd give me little scenes to edit that he would then rip to shreds and say, you have to re-edit this, Sam. This doesn't work. This is awful. And so by the age of 25, I became an editor.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. So let me start by asking you this next question. How many documentaries have you been a part of, be it editor, director, producer, consulting producer?
Well, I've been around 50 years. So I would have to say about 70 films.
70 films.
70 films, but it's a long career.
So Max Roach, what inspired you to even want to do a documentary about him?
I was editing a documentary in 1983 about the poet Langston Hughes. And the director was a gentleman named St. Clair Bourne, a wonderful documentary filmmaker. And he had shot a scene where he had Max perform to one of Langston's poems, a solo, like you saw Max at the end doing that thing with the hi-hats and the cymbals. And I cut the sequence. I showed Saint the cut. He gave me notes. I made some changes. Then I said to Saint, man, somebody should direct or do a doc about Max, man. He's so phenomenal. And Saint turned to me and said, man, you should direct it. And I was startled because I was me, a director, I'm an editor. And he said, no, man, you should direct it. And then a few weeks later, he took me to a club in the village called SOBs. where Max was performing with M Boom, his percussion ensemble. And after we watched the performance, he took me backstage and introduced me to Max. And I pitched Max doing this doc about him. And Max said yes.
Wow.
And then Sate paired me with the associate producer on the Langston Hughes film, a woman named Dolores Elliott. And she went out and she raised about $25,000 from the New York State Council of the Arts. And we went to Max. It's that footage when you see Max on the phone saying, Sam's here with the camera crew. That was the first shoot we did with Max, where he's sitting in that chair with the Northwestern shirt on. We did that shoot at his apartment. And then 2 weeks later, we went down to 42nd Street, 41st Street, and we shot the rehearsal with M. Boom that you see later in the film. And then we had enough money to go to San Diego, where Max was composing a score for a contemporary version of Midsummer Night's Dream. And that's where we shot some of the footage. You see him with the hat on, directing some folks. And, you know, it was the beginning of the journey. I put the cut together in 87, 88, something like that. And I looked at the cut, and I hated the cut. And I showed it to Max, and he didn't respond in a really positive way. So I put it on the shelf for like 5 years. And then I pulled it down. I did some additional interviews, which is not in this cut. And I looked at it, and I hated it again. I put it away for 5 years. I would do that every 5 years. I'd pull it out, put it away, put it out, pull it away. And in 2015, Ben Shapiro, who's the co-director now, he's a buddy, he was a cinematographer, and he had played drums as a young man. And he had done audio interviews with Max around the same time I began shooting with Max. So he said, man, you gotta finish this film. So I said, Ben, if you would help me co-direct this, I think we can finish it. So we raised, I think Ben and I were able to raise about $100,000 to interview Randy Weston, Dee Dee Bridgewater, Questlove, Jimmy Heath, Tootie Heath, you know. And we were able to have enough money to hire an editor. And finally finished it.
Total years. How many years?
35 years. Wow. 35 years. The only film that ever took me that long.
I was going to say. Since we're talking about years, favorite series or doc in the 70s that you did?
70s?
70s.
I did a doc as a second editor in 1977 called Just Crazy About Horses, about the Eastern horse set, dressage riding and carriage riding. And that was really the first sort of major doc that I did with Victor Konevsky. He was really a mentor to me. So that was like an important film for my career in the 70s.
What about Eyes on the Prize?
Eyes on the Prize didn't happen for me until the 80s.
In the 80s,
yeah.
Okay. What's your favorite for the 80s?
Well, 80s, it was two. It was Style Wars, which was about graffiti and breakdancing. Mm-hmm. And then I went to Boston and I got hired as a editor, direct producer on Eyes on the Prize 2 with Henry Hampton and a bunch of different people, Louis Messiah and Judy Richardson and Betty Ciccarelli, a bunch of folks, you know. And that was a real baptism of fire, because I hadn't started shooting Max, so this was really the first directing I was doing.
Okay.
Yeah.
90s.
Oh, you know, those Spike Lee joints that I cut.
First Spike Lee joint, I'm just trying to lay some background. I'm gonna get heavy into Max in a minute. First Spike Lee joint was?
Mo Better Blues.
Second?
Jungle Fever.
Third?
Clockers.
Fourth?
Girl Six, but don't watch that one. Don't look at Girl Six.
But most people don't know you worked with Ed Norton on something you directed.
Oh, By the People, the election of Barack Obama. Yeah. He was the executive producer. He was a character.
Yeah?
Oh, yeah. Pretty intense man.
Well, we, you know, over time, you're the verite, so much that you introduce and you've been credited as one of the most decorated documentarians in history. You're the recipient of the IDA award, which for those of you that don't know, that's the highest achievement in documentary filmmaking globally. So this, of course, adds to it. So let me ask you this about this Max Roach piece. Some of it looked like it was shot, was it 8mm or 16? 16mm.
Well, it was shot 16mm. That's what we shot on, most of it, a lot of it, yeah.
So are you still, were you, although you didn't edit this, correct?
No.
Did you oversee the editing of it?
Yeah, I was a director. What do you think? Wendy, you know.
I everybody doesn't know the process. So I wanted people to know the process. So what were some of the themes and messages that you were hoping that people would learn? There's a quote that Max says when he's talking about music, that it's not being jazz. And Miles Davis makes that same comment.
Yeah,
it's not jazz.
It was, you know, listen, I spent a lot of time with Max from like 87 to 93. And what I admired about him was the fact that he didn't think of himself as a jazz musician. He said that it was about African-American music. That was important to me. The other thing that was important to me was that he had this philosophy, which I have, was that he didn't want to rest on his laurels. He didn't just want to be a musician who played with Charlie Parker, Dizzy Gillespie, and Bud Powell, and Monk. He was going to be a musician who evolved, and you could see that. He goes from those guys, he plays with Clifford Brown and Sonny Rollins. Then he goes and he plays with, you know, Abbey Lincoln and Clifford Jordan. Then he plays with Charles Tolliver and Gary Bartz. Then he plays with the M'Boom group with, you know, Joe Chambers and Warren Smith. Then, you know, he's playing with Bill T. Jones. He's performing with Toni Morrison. He's performing with Cecil Taylor and Archie Shepp. You know, I mean, he's playing with Japanese koto drummers. This guy never rested on his laurels. He kept challenging himself. And I love that. And the other thing about Max that I really love is the fact that he was not just a musician. He had a certain sense about understanding the importance of political activism. You know, he didn't just want to entertain. He understood that was a part of it. But he understood that his music could also be very insightful in terms of social politics. So all of those things made me admire him tremendously. Now, was he a perfect human being? No. You heard that sequence with Julian Priester when he jumped Julian Priester. This guy had anger issues, you know? This guy was, he was complicated, which is also what I also always like about people I'd sort of document. I want to understand that there's layers to human beings that make us complex. I mean, it's you talking about this lady who with the Supreme Court. I mean, she's heroic in that level, but then you tell us about the other parts and you say, whoa, that's what makes human beings interesting, you know? I mean, it's an interesting world. Sometimes it's a sad world. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's frightening. You know, I just told Wendy and I was telling, you know, Emily, I just saw Civil War and I came out depressed. You know, but the world is complicated. So for me, Max is all those things. So that's why I find, you know, this film's probably in my body of work, one of the most important films I've done. And it's the only film I never made any money from.
So you worked on it for 35 years.
Yeah.
You've, in doing something for that long, you didn't have, Bob Shapiro comes on later. Ben comes on later. So did you always have in mind the other people that you would work with, or what did this feel like for you? How large was, how large was your crew in doing all of this?
Well, when we first shot, the crew was just camera, sound, and me and Dolores. And then when I did the second shoot where you don't even see any of that material, it was just me and a camera person. And then when Ben Shapiro came on, since he was a cinematographer, he shot all the other interviews that's in the film now. He did the sound and I did the interviews. It was very small. Sometimes we'd have an AC, assistant camera person, come on. But it was very small, very small. I mean, it was just very tight crew.
So what are your, in working with Max, when Max gets a chance to look at maybe by your third cut, does he offer at any point any major feedback, something else he wanted you to do or add to the film?
I never showed Max another cut. Never. Never did. That was a valuable lesson. Never show the subject the film. Oh. Never, no. Because originally, my idea was the film was just going to be all Max. Mm-hmm. It was going to be no one else but just Max. Mm-hmm. And when I didn't like that approach, and after the years went by, and I decided with Ben that we wanted to bring in people who were connected to Max on a personal level, that's when we really sort of found our footing with it. Okay. And the only time we showed the film besides, you know, when I had showed it earlier to Max, is when we got near the end of this cut, this one that you just saw tonight, we did show his children.
Okay.
Because we had made a deal with the children about, you know, using the footage, getting their blessing, and we did show them a cut. And one of the sons, I won't mention which one, he wasn't particularly ecstatic about that sequence with Max jumping Julian Priester. You know, do you really have to have that in there but my dad? We said yes, man.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because we're complicated.
That's right.
Yeah, people are drawn to flawed characters.
And then he was cool after a while. He was fine.
So in the 35 years again, I'm just trying to think about it because I worked with you from 2018. On an average, how many films have you been doing every year?
Well, the last 5-6 years, I've probably done 10 films. Yeah, about 10 films.
Even not post-retirement. So he retires in 2022 from NYU?
Yeah, as a teacher, yeah. I didn't stop making films then. I stopped teaching.
Right. So, but I'm just saying this to go, especially for our students, to understand you can balance and do more than one thing and be very, very good at it. So
let me jump in and say this. I was trained by this gentleman, Victor Konevsky, in an editing service where we were always multitasking.
Okay.
We were always multitasking. So I learned to multitask. And the reason I can multitask today is because, listen, none of us make these films by ourselves.
True.
You need a team. You need collaborators. You know, you need someone like a Ben Shapiro. You need a camera person. You need a good sound person. You know, you need a good editor. I don't edit my own films. You know, you need a good post-production supervisor. No man is an island when you make a film. You need collaborators. I'm reading a book now about Coppola's American Zoetrope. And he's completely insane to me, Francis Ford Coppola. But the one thing he knew is that he needed Vittorio Storaro to shoot Apocalypse Now. He needed Richie Marx and Jerry Greenberg to edit it. He needed Walter Murch to edit and do sound. He needed Dean Tavrolaris to do production design. You know, he needed Brando and Martin Sheen and Robert Duvall to make the damn movie as actors. You need collaborators. You can't make these films by yourself, no matter what the scale is, from a little small budget film to a $100 million film. It's just, that's not how the film and television business works.
So now we're in the time where people want you to pitch. What's your process at this stage in your career?
Pitch? I still pitch.
You still pitching?
Oh, yeah. Nobody just gives me the money. I still pitch. Everybody still pitches.
Okay. Well, that's good. So I don't feel bad with all
of
my notes.
No, you shouldn't feel bad. I still pitch. I still do like 3 pitches a week.
Wow. Really?
Oh, yeah.
On 3 different?
Oh, yeah. Always pitching.
So is it? Let me ask you. So let me say this to for filmmakers, and we're exploring topics. What should you look for in doing a doc, other than the subject? What are some of the layers that you use to create story?
Well, I'm gonna come at it from 2 different ways.
Okay.
The streamers now and the cable networks, HBO and Netflix and Amazon and Peacock, what they'll say to you when you are going to pitch a project, they'll say, is there a celebrity attached? Is it a true crime? Is it sports related? That's what they're looking for. Now, if you come in there with something like, you know, this film, you know, people are going to say, well, who is Max? Who's going to know him? I don't know, you know. Then you try to make sure in your pitch, if you can engage them in the pitch and tell them that there's a real narrative spine that will be exciting, engaging, dramatic, and important. And sometimes they'll buy into it and sometimes they won't, you know. So it's always a dance. But if you believe in your project, no matter who you are, then you got to go into those pitches with that real sense of, I know I can make this happen. And then you just hope that one of these execs will say, oh, I think that really sounds interesting, Sam. Let me go back to my team and let's talk. We'll talk about it and get back to you. Now, you keep your fingers crossed that they'll come back and say, we're going to green light this. Or they'll say, it's a great idea, Sam, but we're going to pass, you know. And 9 times out of 10, these streamers, these cable stations, they pass. But never give up, folks. Mm-hmm. Always figure out another way to go back at them again. Never give up.
So with this particular film, how many other films were made in the, even the last year? I know you, when did you wrap
this
on this
one?
Mm-hmm.
We finished this film spring, May 2023.
So did you already have a buyer before you finished?
This one we sold to American Masters, the public television series. They came in and gave us $350,000 to finish it, which enabled us to pay for the music rights and to license the archival footage.
May I ask how much the archival footage was?
I think the archival footage in this film came like at $125,000, which was cheap.
Yeah.
Cheap.
So I know you like music. I know you like sports. You did another documentary that I recommend everyone see. It's called Sammy Davis Jr., I've Gotta Be Me.
Yeah.
If you have not seen it, and that was also
American Masters
as well. What do you find has been some of the difficulties that you've encountered during the post-production of doing these? You've got sound, you've got people talking, you've got music. What's that layering process? It doesn't always go as smoothly as people. I was looking at something about TLC on Netflix, and I was
that's not. I would say, it's, you know, the process in post-production is never, from my experience, it's never really figuring out how to bring all the elements together in terms of sound and picture and graphics and stuff. I mean, I've done it a long time, so you know, you bring on the right people to help you make that happen. Listen, the biggest challenge with finishing any kind of film is how do you deal with feedback from executives who you have to answer to when they watch your cuts? That's the biggest challenge. I mean, you know, it's like I always say, and I say this all the time, I hate notes from executives. I hate notes. Every time an executive gives me a note, I want to throw up. But the professional part of me understands that they gave me the money, so I got to sort of address those their issues.
Right.
You always have to address the issues. I don't have to like them, but I have to address them. And I have to address them in a very professional way, you know? And I always do that. I never not do that, you know? And so the physical process, unless we have a crunch deadline, is not that difficult, you know? It's how you deal with the response to the notes, how you respond to the notes that you're given by execs, you know? And, you know, you sometimes will challenge those notes from the exec, and sometimes you'll give in on some notes, you know?
Have you ever just totally ignored the notes?
Yeah, when I was young and full of piss and vinegar. Yeah, when I was a young man, when I was in my 30s, I always tell this great story. Do I have time to tell a story? I was cutting a little short film for Spike for a series that was on HBO called Subway Stories. And Spike had shot this little interesting piece about these two men, one black, one Latino. They get into a verbal scuffle on the subway in New York. But then Spike turned it into a boxing match on the subway where they had on trunks and gloves, and the people in the subway became the audience. And they were fighting in the subway, and he shot it in slow motion, except he had the actors act in slow motion. And it was fun. But he had given me like 6 notes to make changes. And I was in a really funky mindset. And I looked at those notes, I said, these are dumb notes, you know? And I didn't do any of those changes. I didn't do any. I just felt like, what am I, this doesn't make sense. I'm not doing this, I'm not doing this. So I sent him a cut and he calls me up and he says, Sam, you didn't do any of the changes. And I say, and I don't know, I must have been like crazy that day. I said, they didn't make any sense to me, Spike. And it was like quiet on the other end of the phone. And the response was, make the changes. I made the changes. But I was 38 years old and I was a little hot-headed, you know?
So, I know you love music, you love sports. What's your favorite sports film that you've done? Or about a sports personality?
Oh, I did one 3 years ago about Arthur Ashe. I loved that. I enjoyed that. That was fun. That was a real pleasure. Just to see him. And I love tennis, so that was really interesting to me.
So on average, how long is it taking to make some of these other films? Are they commissioned? I know people bring things to you. I bring things to you all the time.
Yeah.
How many of these are your original pads? Like,
Not a one.
Huh? It's
not a one.
Not one?
Not one.
You're for sale?
I'm for sale. Not a one. They all came to me. Max is the baby.
Oh, Max is, okay. Max is your passion project.
Yeah.
Is there anything that you want to do right now that you just haven't had the time, that now that you're retired, you can move at your own pace? Is there any subject that you want to talk about?
About a year ago, I decided I was going to do a little short film that was going to be both archival and animation about, in 1957, Thelonious Monk and John Coltrane played at a club in New York City on the Lower East Side called the Five Spot. And Coltrane played with Monk for 6 months, and musically he went to a whole nother level. So I decided I'm going to do a little film about that. So I said, I need to talk to somebody about that period. Who can I talk to? So I called a wonderful friend, a colleague of mine, who's also a jazz writer and a professor named Ashley Kahn. And he had written books about Coltrane. And I talked to him for an hour and a half on the phone. I did a Zoom and I recorded it. Then I called Robin Kelly. Anybody know Robin Kelly? I called Robin Kelly, who'd written the book about Monk. Big opus book about Monk, and I spoke to him for an hour and a half. Then I had those interviews transcribed. Then I did my own paper cut, you know, put it together. And then I said, I need to get somebody to do some animation. So this guy who had done animation for my film about the Negro Baseball League, The League, mm-hmm. named Nixon Fong. I called Nixon in Taiwan. I said, Nixon, I'm gonna send you my paper cut. Think you can give me some animation? How much would it cost me? And he said, well, maybe between 10 and 15,000. I said, I'll give you some money, man. So I'm like crazy, you know? Then I hire a young editor. I said, I need you to take my paper cut and put a cut together. So I gave him like 1,600 bucks, you know? Then I said, shoot, I'm gonna end up paying for this myself. But I wanna do it. So I'm trying to get it. It'll take me like another year, but I'll get it done. A little short, 12, 13 minutes.
All right, so can I ask you a question?
Sure.
As an editor, who's been your favorite director to work with?
Oh, Spike.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I mean, listen, he's a complicated guy. He's not easy. But I would say to you, in terms of my own creativity, mm-hmm. it went like that working with Spike every time.
Wow.
Every time. No, Spike's, you know, he's a brilliant film director.
Who's your favorite editor?
D.D. Allen. D.D. Allen is the grand dame of film editing. Anybody who knows who she is, from Serpico to Bonnie and Clyde to The Hustler, you know, to Dog Day Afternoon, you know, to Odds Against Tomorrow with Harry Belafonte, mm-hmm. D.D. Allen was a master editor. She was brilliant, absolutely brilliant.
So better than you?
You better believe she's better than me.
Love it.
Yeah, she was brilliant, brilliant.
So you did another film that came out, and congratulations, about Lowndes County.
Yeah.
Can you share with us about Lowndes County and the road to black freedom?
Black power.
Black power.
About 5 years ago, a colleague of mine, Geeta Ganbir, reached out to me and said these two young men, one named Demophon Paxton and the other named Van Newkirk, were developing a documentary that looked at Lowndes County and SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and how important they were to the people in Lowndes County, Alabama, back in 1965, 66, around the same time that Dr. King and the SCLC did the march from Selma to Montgomery, right, which we all know about. But not many people know about what SNCC and what SNCC was doing in Lowndes County. So she said, these guys want to do this documentary. They initially wanted to do it as a multi-part series. And, you know, in all honesty, I was kind of like, I'm not interested, Geeta. I don't want to do it. I mean, I'm not really interested. But she was extremely persistent, and she got me to get on board, that we were co-direct. And we were able to get the money from Participant that just folded and Peacock. And we started shooting interviews in Washington, D.C., which was great. Then we went down to Alabama, to Lowndes County, and into Selma, and we shot down there for like a week. And that was really great, because I was saying to someone the other day, when I was sitting in Lowndes County talking to these people in that community, I felt like I was home, because my family's from Mississippi and Georgia. So when I hear those voices and that accent, I feel like I'm home. I like talking to my aunts.
You feel like you're home when you hear talking like this.
That's right.
You love that.
I love it, man.
Like sugar cane.
Yeah.
It's like sweet tea.
It's like sitting with my cousins, give them sweet tea. And so I embraced the project. So it was really, really fun. And it was a great crew. You know, we had Henry shooting.
Oh, Henry Adebanaje.
Yeah, he shot. So it was a really very powerful, powerful experience. And it was also important, I think, for SNCC and those folks, Stokely Carmichael, to get their flowers.
Right.
You know, so yeah, it turned out, I watched it the other night down in Los Angeles at Santa Monica College. It holds up pretty well. Yeah. It's not bad. Not embarrassing.
And yeah. That film received an Emmy for?
Yeah, for archival research.
Archival research, congratulations.
Yeah, yeah.
So I see there's a theme. Go ahead. Go. So looking at your career, although people things bring to you, but it sounds like they bring those stories that people don't know. And even if they know the subject, they don't know the inner workings of who those persons are.
That's right.
But there are also something else I'm able to see is you care about civil rights and the different methodologies in which they are communicated. And
yeah, I do.
I've always said that documentary has an unprecedented manner to change the way we live.
If you pay attention.
If you pay attention.
Yeah.
Well, when I was growing up, the only place we watched documentaries were on PBS. Now everybody's making there's a documentary about everything.
Yeah, I watched a doc this morning, and I was interested about Alexander McQueen, you know, the fashion designer?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know anything about that dude.
Really?
But you know, I knew a little bit. But but I'm watching it today in my hotel room. I said, wow, this guy's kind of interesting. You know, complicated, you know? And I liked how it was shot. You know, so I called up this producer that I'm working with. I'm supposed to be going to South Africa in June to start shooting a doc about Desmond Tutu. So I called the producer. I said, Bea, man, you seen the Alexander McQueen doc? We need to shoot those interviews like this, man. I don't want them to be just like that. I want to get this folks to be tight, so I want to get intimate with them, you know. So to me, I was saying to Wendy, you know, that today, just being here in Santa Barbara with Wendy and all the folks she's introduced me to, I just done learned so much today. I learned about pornography, you know. I learned about her trip to D.C. You know, I learned about Harry and Meghan. I said, man. That's what makes life interesting, man. I mean, I'm like, so this is an important thing for those of you who are interested in documentaries or just, you know, anything about filmmaking. Curiosity is invaluable. Never lose your sense of curiosity. I mean, because it opens up worlds to you. It really does.
Are we on time? We have time to start taking questions.
When it comes to the zeitgeist of the music, do you think that its meaning has changed and finds different value in contemporary times? Or do you think that the intention of Roach's music remains like sacrament?
I personally think Roach's music really still is important. I think if you listen to it now, it feels as fresh that as it did when he first did it, you know? And I think that if you think about the young musicians who are performing this music now, they are taking a page from him in terms of understanding how to take this music out to the public and give it another level of gravitas. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you for this wonderful film. Seeing the second half of the 20th century through the drum kit of Max Roach is just fantastic perspective. First, I have a question for the audience. I wonder how many were here for Max and how many were here for Sam Pollard. And the worlds could meet together in the middle, because some it might be have been exclusive for some until now. But that's beautiful. The interviews are fantastic.
Yeah,
and seeing so many heroes up there talking about this. I just wonder, were there some that you weren't able to use? And if there were some, which interviews would you wish you could have had to put in this film?
Everybody we shot, except for one gentleman, is in the film. We did reach out to a couple of musicians, and somehow, one of them was Gary Bartz. And somehow he never responded to me, you know? And I was hoping I could get Gary Bartz, because I love that whole period when Max had Gary and Charles Tolliver and Jimmy Merritt and Stanley Cowell. And the only other musician I reached out to who turned me down, but he wanted money, and I didn't want to pay him any money. It was Billy Harper, the saxophonist. That was the only other one. Everybody else said yes. And years ago, before Ben got involved, I took Abby Lincoln out to a really fancy dinner and gave her a lot of food, went and bought some wine for her. And then I asked if she would do an interview about Max, and she said no.
Yeah. Hi, Sam. Truly phenomenal doc. You know, did fantastic job. Starting as like an editor myself and then moving on to filmmaking during my time here at UCSB, I was wondering, what do you think you learned from your first time trying to direct this? As obviously you mentioned, it's one of your babies, to now finishing the doc after taking so much time to finalize and realizing it. What do you think you learned, or like you think anyone here from filmmaker to audience enjoyer could learn from that?
What I learned was patience and to sort of not let my ego rule how I was thinking about this film. I was a much younger man. I didn't have as much patience, and I wanted it to be fantastic and brilliant. And I didn't know that I had to let things kind of mellow. You know, I had to things kind of let it slowly unfold. And by the time I got to this point in my life, I'm a much more patient human being than I was back in those days. That's the biggest thing I learned, yeah. And if you're an editor, I'm just gonna say this to you, if you're an editor, the most important thing for anybody who wants to be an editor is to watch films, man. And don't watch them once, watch them twice, watch them three times. I've watched every film five times, be it Hitchcock's 39 Steps or Tarantino's Reservoir Dogs or Fellini's 8 1/2 or Wong Kar-wai's In the Mood for Love. I watch them all the time, because every time I rewatch a film, when I was an editor, even now I still do it, I see something else from an editorial perspective in terms of rhythm, in terms of pacing, in terms of dramatic action, in terms of the way an actor engages. I was watching a film on the plane coming out called The Beekeeper. It's awful. But there was a scene between Felicia Rashad and Jason Stratham, which was so awkwardly cut, I said, Jesus Christ, Stratham can't act. He can't act at all, you know? Then I watched a scene I was watching Magnolia in my hotel room the other day. Remember Magnolia? The scenes between Tom Cruise and that lady reporter, Tom Cruise is off the chain, man. What a performance. And the way that they cut that stuff, Dylan Tischner cut that film, man, oh man, the performances are fantastic, but the editing of those performances are phenomenal, man. Study the craft. I always say that, study the craft. I could go on for editing all day, man.
I feel so deeply privileged to be in the room with you. Thank you so much for coming to talk with us. And thank you, Wendy, for bringing Mr. Pollard. Getting back to the issue of Spike Lee, the incredible filmmaker Spike Lee, I've been watching his films since they've come out. Mm-hmm. And I'm so glad you mentioned all of those films and cut all those films. And, you know, I have great respect and do the right thing and so on. But one day, I guess in the late 90s, I saw a film that really astounded me, and it's the film Four Little Girls. Right. I thought, wow, who knew Spike Lee was a documentary filmmaker and just as good at documentary as with fiction, or maybe better. Then, you know, cut forward a few decades, I said, wait a minute, what about Sam Pollard? You know, what is the through line here? And I've seen Lowndes County, and I just am so amazed by your work on, you know, the violence of racism in America. Yeah. And so I would love to learn a little bit about your, you know, what you brought to Four Little Girls and what was your experience cutting that film.
Well, with Four Little Girls, one of the first questions when Spike and I both went down to Birmingham and shot those first interviews, and one of the things that we would come back when we got back to New York, we would go to 40 Acres to the edit room at 7 in the morning, and we would spend 3 hours together watching the dailies, watching all the interviews, and talk about what we liked from those interviews. Then he would leave me alone to start the edit. But one of the first questions Spike asked me as we were starting the editing process, he says, do you think this film needs narration? And I turned to Spike and said, no, man. I said, we got the people who can tell you this story. We don't need a narrator. And that was sort of the thing that sort of gave me the momentum to put this material together. And Spike also knew that, you know, he knew my documentary background, you know. So it was sort of this really good meeting of the minds where I felt so comfortable with the material. And again, it was that same reaction I had when I interviewed the people in Lowndes County. Listening to all these people in Birmingham, it was like listening to my aunt, you know, from Mississippi. Listening to my Uncle Mac in New York City, who came from Mississippi, my Uncle Charlie, you know, my Aunt Liza. It was like I was home. So every time I was looking at those interviews and selecting those interviews, I just felt it. I just connected with it. And Spike understood that too. So, you know, it was sort of like understanding that he gave me room to take my sort of personality and my where I came from and bring to material where he also comes from too. He's got Southern roots. So that sort of made it work in terms of this relationship, you know. But, you know, it was, for me, doing Four Little Girls and When the Levees Broke, those were, for me, just important documentaries. And because Spike really understood that how important it was to get intimate with these folks, you know.
Hi, I'm John Nathan. I teach jazz here, actually, at UCSB.
Good,
teach
man,
jazz
good.
Performance. And hi, Wendy.
Hi.
We talked a couple of years ago. So I'm one of those people here that came for the Max documentary. And I actually spent a lot of time with Max at University of Massachusetts.
Oh, you did?
In the 80s.
Nice.
Yeah, a lot of time. Years and years. So I want to thank you because I learned so much from this that I never knew before. As being a student of jazz history, I still didn't know a lot of what you brought to us. So thank you very much.
You're welcome.
My question, two of them, best jazz documentary that you can think of?
I got two.
And best movie about jazz that's not a documentary? Because okay. I have so many problems with the
yeah,
jazz
I know.
Movies.
But here, I'm going to say there's three to me, three great jazz documentaries. There's one that was done in 1968 by a gentleman named Tom Reichman called Mingus. Remember when Mingus in the house with the gun with the family, with his daughter? I love that film, man. And then he's performed at Lenny at the Turnpike, you know, with, who's on piano? Walter Bishop Jr. is on piano. Then there's a buddy of mine did a little short film about Jackie McLean called Jackie McLean on Mars, which I love, you know. Because Jackie McLean has a section there, so why can't I be a god and a king, man, when he's with Jackie Byer? And my third favorite documentary, and I told this to somebody yesterday, I said, really? I said, I love it, is Chet Baker, Let's Get Lost. Brilliant, man. Bruce Weber gave me a love letter to Chet Baker. Now, in terms of feature films, I hate Round Midnight. I hate Bird. Probably the only jazz feature film that I kind of like was the one that Ethan Hawke played Chet Baker. Remember that one?
No, I don't know that one.
Yeah, he played Chet Baker. That's probably the only one I kind of like. Usually, I don't like him. I don't like him at all. You know, everybody thinks I like Round Midnight. I can't stand it. I can't stand it. No, it's hard with feature films. It's hard, man. Maybe, and this is even not jazz. You remember Young Man with a Horn, Kirk Douglas?
Yeah.
I like that, but it ain't jazz.
Powerful. And so I wondered if you could talk more about your work and your experience in, you know, doing so much on civil rights and black power, to think about the place of our art and our struggle in the world and the connection to Africa and to other places in the world where people are oppressed, and how people have viewed your work who are not from America to understand what black culture has been about that struggle. And if you also sense the kind of way in which that turn towards infiltration and policing damaged that movement, or did you see it emerge again and become stronger? Because it feels like a very scary place right now.
Well, this is what I would say. I would say history has a tendency to repeat itself, you know, and the kind of infiltration that we saw in the 60s, where I'm a child of the 60s, I was a teenager in the 60s, I didn't understand what was going on with COINTELPRO and the FBI, you know, infiltrating the Black Panther Party and all these different organizations. But the thing to remember is that this thing continues. The cycle never stops. You know, the challenge we always face is fighting it. You got to constantly fight it. You know, and you see that with the Black Lives Movement. You see that with these students now. So, you know, the one thing I've learned in all these years of making these films is that the activism is vitally important to making change. And you need young people, old people, people with who have, you know, a belief in saying things have to change, fighting the system. It has to happen, you know, because if you don't, we'll become an authoritarian country, you know. So to me, it's like what I was just saying earlier. Today's been like a sort of a wake-up call for me, just arousing my curiosity about life. When I'm working on these films about the 60s and the 70s and the 80s, for me, it's like me understanding, oh, what was I missing? You know, what was I missing back in 68 when I was 18? And didn't really quite understand, you know, where my place was in the Black Power struggle and what was happening in civil rights. What was I missing in the 90s when Bill Clinton was in office, you know? Was I kind of coasting, you know? You have to sort of challenge yourself to understand what it means to live in this world and what you have to do, you know, to make things happen. I hope, and I don't know if that works all the time, that these films, you know, will make people want to be curious and understand, wow, this level of complexity that we see back in 1968, it still exists in 2024. You know, and part of me thinks, man, I'm 74 years old, and has the world gotten crazier? Maybe it was just always crazy.
I'm going to give Sam, before we close, I'm going to give Sam his flowers on stage. I did this a little bit earlier. One of the great things about being a filmmaker is being able to learn from the greats. I was blessed to be able to learn from the great beasts and then bestowed a team of great leadership. But one of the great things, Sam, that I love about you is that every single person on set, no matter whether they were the intern or been nominated for an Academy Award, you always gave us an opportunity to learn and grow. You didn't tell us what to do. you would say, well, you could do this, this, or this.
Yeah.
And here's the outcome. So thank you for not just doing that as a filmmaker, but for the so many people that I work with now learned under you at NYU. Some of them said you gave them a C in documentary film space. And that's when they knew they weren't going to do documentaries. But you always brought an opportunity for all people to learn. And I hope that's something that I'm able to give my students as well as they leave and one day come back and work with me. So thank you again for coming. Thank all of you for taking out the time of your busy evening to come and spend some time with us. And I hope you got something from this talk back as well as the documentary.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.